Perhaps no organization within the Catholic Church generates more controversy than Opus Dei. But is that controversy warranted? We're going to look into the details of Opus Dei, how its purpose, how it was founded on today's episode of Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, as always, I want to encourage you to smash that like button, to subscribe to the channel, but don't hit the notify bell because you have a life outside of the internet. Speaking of the internet, if you are on social media, you can follow Crisis Magazine at all the various social media channels. At Crisis Mag is where our handle usually is. So please do so. And you can find out the latest about what we're doing, our latest articles, and you can comment on them. Also, I want to encourage people to join our Telegram channel. It's been growing, which I've been very happy about. And this is where you can comment on our articles. There's a link to our Telegram channel at the bottom of every single article we put on Crisis Magazine. I encourage you to click on that. Go ahead and join Telegram. It's a great channel. It's not censored really in any way. And join the conversation. Okay, so let's go ahead and dive into Opus Dei. So Opus Dei is kind of funny because it has an outsized reputation. The last I checked, I think there's about 95,000 members of Opus Dei. And if you think about it, the Catholic Church is over a billion members. And so 95,000 isn't very big in comparison to a billion. Mass, yes. But at the same time, it's well known and it's considered by some to be very influential in the church. In fact, if you dive into the internet long enough, you will see that there are conspiracy theories about how it runs things. I've been accused of being an Opus Dei infiltrator or something. Like when some traditionalists criticize me, they think it's because my association with Opus Dei, which I'll get into in a minute. And there's also the accusation that it's just for the rich, that basically it's just organization for rich Catholics. There was the controversy about 20 years ago when the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown came out, in which one of the characters was an albino assassin monk who was a member of Opus Dei. And I will just address that at the beginning. There is no such thing as an albino assassin monk in Opus Dei. Why? Number one, because there are no monks in Opus Dei. We'll talk about that in a minute. Number two, my guess is that if there was an assassin in Opus Dei, if Opus Dei found out, he would be asked to leave. Now, there could be albinos in Opus Dei. I don't know. I haven't met one, but yeah, there could be. So no albino assassin monks. But Dan Brown was able to use Opus Dei as this evil organization within the Catholic Church because it had a reputation that was questionable. And another accusation against Opus Dei has cult-like practices. Some people have accused it of being a cult, somewhat like the Legionaries of Christ. And so some problems with that. Okay, so let's talk about whether or not these things are true and actually what is Opus Dei. So first, I just want to explain my own history with Opus Dei. I am not a member of Opus Dei. I have never been a member of Opus Dei. I feel like I'm in front of Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s or something, but I'm just not. When I was about 15 years ago, I was living in the Washington, D.C. area. I was the owner of a software development company. I had young children. I was a relatively young father back then. And I will admit that I struggled with balancing work, family life, and I guess you'd call it church life, growing in holiness, trying to be a better Catholic. And one of the main problems I had was I saw work as almost an obstacle to growing in holiness. As, like I said, I owned a software development company, very busy, lots of responsibilities. And of course, then with also having a young family I was trying to support, it just felt like at times too much. And I felt like I couldn't really grow my spiritual life because work was keeping me from that. And I knew some other dads who were like that, some other men I was friends with who felt the same way. And it was around that time I discovered the teachings of St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, and I started to really appreciate them. One of the reasons I started following was because looking into it is because Scott Hahn is a member of Opus Dei and he wrote a book about it back around this time. And that was like, well, if it's good enough for him, I should look into it. It might be helpful for me. And I found it was very helpful that, in fact, the teachings of St. Jose Maria were helpful in helping me to recognize that work is not an obstacle to the spiritual life. In fact, it's a means to grow in holiness. That's the teaching, really, of Opus Dei and of St. Jose Maria Escrivá. So I started attending meetings in the D.C. There's a I can't remember what they call it, a group, a chapter, something like that, in Washington, D.C. I started attending their monthly evenings of reflection. I went to a retreat, a silent weekend retreat, Opus Dei retreat. Did not see any albino SS monks there. I also was a member of a circle for a while, which is basically it's some men get together. I think there's women's circles too, but they get together and go through different teachings, San Jose Maria, things like that. I actually wasn't member of that very long because I joined it a few months before I moved out of town. And where I moved didn't have an Opus Dei chapter. But during that time, that was probably about 4 or 5 years, maybe, I was involved. What was interesting is not once was I ever asked to become a member of Opus Dei. And we'll talk about that when we're talking about the cult-like practices in a little bit. But essentially, I liked it. And during this time, I started finishing up my master's degree in theology at Franciscan University, Steubenville. And one of my assignments was to write a paper on the spirituality of a saint. I got to pick whatever saint I wanted to, and I could write about the spirituality. I first saw of like St. Francis of Assisi or something, or St. Teresa of Avila or St. Teresa of Lisieux, something like that. But actually, I think my wife was like, why don't you do St. Jose Maria Escrivá? Because I bet you nobody else is doing that. And I was like, that's a great idea. So I wrote that paper. Eventually, that became a published book. Here it is right here, Holiness for Everyone, The Practical Spirituality of St. Jose Maria Escrivá. Now, no, this is not the paper I wrote. That was academic. It was much shorter. This has been popularized, made it readable for non-academics and things like that. So And by the way, there's a link to, if you want to get this book, I think it's great. Obviously I wrote it. If you want to get this book, there's a link to it in the show notes. So I ended up writing a book about St. Jose Maria Escrivá because I really appreciated how his teachings helped me to recognize that work is not an obstacle to holiness, but it's actually the means in which most of us, lay people in particular, it's the means in which we become holy. So it helped in that holiness work balance, I guess you would say. So now what about Opus Dei itself? So I say I really love the teachings of St. Jose Maria Escrivá and that they helped me very much. In fact, that's the purpose of the book, Holiness for Everyone, is what I learned. I mean, the joke is when this came out, some of my friends were like, oh, you're so holy, you're going to tell us how to be holy. And I know there's a danger of that when you write a book like this, but the point of this isn't that I'm holy and so you should listen to me. The point of it is that St. Jose Maria is holy and he has given us a means to holiness that I think is very beneficial people follow. So what I'm doing is I'm basically putting this in book form of his teachings because what I found was most books about St. Jose Maria Escrivá are Opus Dei books. They're for Opus Dei members. They're written by Opus Dei members, for Opus Dei members. And I'm not a member of Opus Dei. And so I was kind of like, hey, let's talk about St. Jose Maria Escrivá outside of Opus Dei. For those people who are not members of Opus Dei, can he help them? And I'd say enthusiastically, yes. But what about Opus Dei itself? Why is it so controversial? And what is it? So essentially, St. Jose Maria Escrivá, who was born, I think, in 1902, and he died in 1975, so he's a relatively modern saint. He had this vision, and he had a couple literal visions. He had this vision of trying to help mostly lay people, lay Catholics, grow in holiness in ordinary life. And he talked about work a lot. And work for him, by the way, and for all of us, doesn't mean you have a job necessarily. A stay-at-home mom has work, more work than most of us, in fact. And so her work is her taking care of her kids, or tending the house, things like that. So when I'm talking about work, I don't want you to think if you, for example, are a stay-at-home mom, you don't have work. We all know you have the most important work in the world. And I actually do believe that. And so Opus Dei, though, so St. Jose Maria had this vision. And so he wanted a structure to help him to spread his teachings about holiness in ordinary life. And the problem was there was no real structure in the Catholic Church to do that. The religious order wouldn't cut it because this was supposed to be for lay people. He didn't want lay. He was okay. He was very supportive of people joining religious orders, but lay people, he knew they're not going to join religious orders. They can't. And so he didn't think a religious order was appropriate. You could have like an apostolic. I can't remember what the term is. Something of apostolic. It's like a group, but that didn't really fit what he wanted. He wanted something more formal than that. And so he struggled with that, but he founded what he called Opus Dei, the work of God. And the purpose of Opus Dei was to spread his teachings so that there would be, his teachings would spread beyond just what he could tell people, because he started having followers who really believed in this. And he also wanted to ordain, he wanted priests that could do this. And so Opus Dei became this organization that would include priests, but would also include mostly lay people. In fact, priests would be just some of the men in Opus Dei, laymen Opus Dei, who were celibate, who would decide to become priests, and not very many. In fact, I think it's 2% of the members of Opus Dei are priests right now. And so he wanted an organization that included this. It would include priests, include lay people, and include different types of lay people. So lay people who would be lay association of the faithful. Thank you, Matthew, who just threw that into the comments. I appreciate that. I could not think of it. And so Opus Dei would include priests. It would also include lay people, but lay people who would be full-time members of Opus Dei would be part of it, a smaller part, maybe 20%. And then the rest of the members of Opus Dei would be people who are not, I mean, they're full-time members in the sense that they're fully members, but they don't work for Opus Dei. They basically just work in the world, and they're members of Opus Dei as janitors, as professors, as whatever the case, software developers, whatever the case may be. So that's the purpose of Opus Dei. Now, the problem was, like I said, there was no church structure that allowed for what St. Jose Maria asked for. And so it took years to finally a structure created called a personal prelature. And there's only one personal prelature in the world right now, and that's Opus Dei. And I think it was 1982 is when it became a personal prelature after St. Jose Maria's death. But a personal prelature is essentially, it's almost like a pseudo diocese that's not geographically bound. So it has an ordinary, it has somebody in charge of it. I'm not sure if it's called an ordinary. I think it's called a prelate, not an ordinary, who's in charge. And people who are in the personal prelature, i.e. members, full members of Opus Dei, they in a certain sense answer to the prelate of Opus Dei. They follow him, but they're also members of their geographic diocese. This is a little bit different from, like, for example, the ordinariate, the Anglican ordinariate, because that's more like a diocese, a worldwide diocese. If you're a member of an ordinariate, you're actually not a member of your diocese. Your diocese is the ordinariate. So you answer to the bishop, the ordinary of the ordinariate, not your diocese. With the personal prelature, you're a member of the personal prelature, but you're also a member of the diocese in which you reside. So what this did was it allowed for the furthering of Opus Dei. And so again, the members of Opus Dei are priests. Like I said, it's 2%. Then you have what are called the supernumeraries, kind of a fancy word, but all it basically means is members of Opus Dei who aren't like fully inside, they're not working for him inside. Super doesn't mean better, but more like outside. So they're in the outside world. And so if you find out that somebody's a member of Opus Dei and they just have a regular job, they're likely a supernumerary of Opus Dei. And then you also have the numeraries of Opus Dei. And those are people who are members and they work full time for Opus Dei. So you would know somebody if they're a numerary because they would tell you their job basically is working for Opus Dei. And essentially then, numeraries also are celibate. So, I mean, they're full-time with, it's almost like a religious order in that sense, but not quite. And there's also part of the numerary, one of the parts of the numerary kind of group are women who work full-time kind of taking care of the houses of Opus Dei. And so they do the domestic work, so to speak. Now, I will say, okay, now let me take a step back for a second. So essentially all this I explain because it should be obvious that in an essence, there's nothing nefarious about this. There's nothing about that organizational structure or the purpose of Opus Dei or why St. Jose Maria Escriva founded it that should make us question it. Now, we'll get into how it's run. We'll talk about that in a minute. But just the foundations of it are essentially just a priest who had a vision of how he could help people grow in holiness, and he created a structure, and the church helped him create that structure in order for that to happen. That's it. I mean, it's not really controversial. Now, I will say, okay, now let's talk about how it's run. Now, I will say Opus Dei does focus on influencing the influential, I guess you could say. And so you often will see Opus Dei chapters. And again, I don't think they're called chapters, but I can't remember the name of them right now. Opus Dei chapters will start typically in areas like New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago. They often will be close to universities, good universities. And that was intentional. They're not the Franciscans. The Franciscans, you know, in theory, like the CFRs, Franciscan Friars Renewal, they will go only to the poorest areas of the world. In fact, they have it in their charter that if an area they have a house in gets too well off, too prosperous, they will leave, because their charism is to the poor and living with the poor. That's not Opus Dei. Opus Dei members do help the poor, but their work is mostly focused on the influential. And that, like I said, that's intentional, because St. Jose Maria felt like a witness of if the influential were witnessing for Catholicism, it would influence lots of people for Catholicism. I mean, it's pretty basic math there. So for example, if you have a senator who is a practicing Catholic, he's more likely to influence people towards Catholicism if he's living out his faithfully than perhaps a janitor at a elementary school. Now, to be clear, St. Jose Maria made it very clear that all work is noble. That's honest work, you know, obviously not prostitution or something like that, but all honest work is noble. So the janitor at the elementary school has work that's just as important, just as noble as the president of the United States or even the Pope. And so that was very clear to him. But in practice, Opus Dei does try to influence the influential. And I think they've gotten some criticism for that. I know they've gotten criticism for that, because it looks like, oh, they just care about the rich. I would say the rich people need Jesus too. I mean, you know, the poor need Jesus, the middle class need Jesus, and the rich need Jesus. So I have no problem with an organization that has more of a focus on the wealthy than they do on the non-wealthy. Now, as long as they're not saying, of course, that it's wealthiness is holiness or something like that, like prosperity gospel, which they don't. As long as they're not saying that, you're fine. But essentially what they are saying is that they want to influence the influential. Now, as far as the accusations of Opus Dei being a cult, I think these are serious, and I think there is some truth to this. In my experience, there's no truth to it. I will say that. My own personal experience. Like I said, my main experience with Opus Dei was in Washington, D.C., although I do know priests and members from other cities, particularly Chicago, just through various work and other things I've done. And like I said, I've not seen anything that would suggest cult-like behavior. Like I said, I wasn't even asked to be a member of Opus Dei. Now, maybe they just didn't like me. They're like, you're not good enough for the cult. I don't know. But here I was, you know, owner of a software development company, involved in Opus Dei for a few years. I was friends with one of the numeraries who worked full-time. I would meet with him regularly. He never once asked me to become a member. Now, if I had said to him, I'm considering becoming a member of Opus Dei, a supernumerary, I'm sure he would have been like, okay, let's talk about that. Let's see if that's something that fits in your life and is a real call that you have. So I think honestly that I've never heard anything about, I've never experienced personally cult-like behavior in Opus Dei. Now, I will say though, I have talked to people I trust who have had experiences of perhaps them being more cult-like. I think, for example, I've heard of multiple people say like the Boston group has maybe has more high pressure tactics. And this might be in the past, it may no longer be true. But the group in Boston is a little bit more high pressure than the group in DC obviously is. And maybe it's just a matter of who is kind of running the local groups. And some of them might be more high pressure than others. I don't know. I can't say if that's true or not. Like I said, I haven't experienced it. So I do think that is something that Opus Dei should always be on guard against, and not becoming cult-like, not being too pushy about who joins them. Now, I will say also another reason they've gotten accusations of being cult-like is mostly due to the numerary assistants, the women who join, become numeraries, and then they do the domestic work, because that life is a little bit, I mean, it is pretty restricted. I mean, they basically live at a Opus Dei home, and they like a retreat center or something like that, and they do all the domestic work, and that's their life. Now, in modern minds, we have a tendency to think that's awful. I mean, it's like, you know, we all kind of have that feminist influence that somehow these women are not fulfilled. I don't buy that. I think women have done that for millennia, and they can live a fulfilling life. Now, obviously, if a woman joins that and wants to leave and somehow isn't allowed to or discouraged from leaving, that's wrong. And so if that happens, that's to be condemned. But just the existence of organization of women that basically just do domestic work, that's their job. They're celibate, and that's their job. That's what they do. That in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing evil about that. There's nothing cult-like in that. It's more about how it's practiced. So if it's more like you can check in, but you can't check out type of thing in some locations, well, obviously that should be investigated and not happen. So I think the problem is that there's certain traditionally Catholic ways of doing things that can be considered cult-like today. I think we have to be careful what we say is cult-like. Because like, for example, how Saint Benedict would have run his monastery in the 6th century today probably would have been called cult-like, even at the time it was considered moderate. And so we have to have a more broad view of what that means. Not to say we shouldn't obviously be worried about that. And I also think there's some accusation of cult-like behavior among Opus Dei because of an association with the Legionaries of Christ, which really is cult-like. I mean, they really do have cult issues. And particularly when they had their founder, their monster founder. And so I think because they both kind of came to prominence at the same time, they're very similar, considered kind of conservative Catholic organizations and things like that. Legion of Christ is different because it's an actual religious order, whereas Opus Dei is not. But I think there's always been an association between the two, but I think it's unfair. They're really separate. They're nothing alike. And ultimately, one was founded by a saint, one was founded by a devil. So I don't think we should have any connections between the two. Okay, so, now another criticism of Opus Dei that I think we should be addressed is kind of this idea, these conspiracy theories that surround them, that basically they run the church. Now, here's the thing. A few years ago, I discounted most conspiracy theories. Then in the past 2 years, I found out that most conspiracy theories are actually right. I mean, when it comes to COVID, when it comes to how the church is run in a lot of ways, a lot of the craziest conspiracy theories turned out to be conspiracy facts. And so I am much more open to the truthfulness or veracity of conspiracy theories. And the conspiracy theory of Opus Dei is that somehow they kind of manage people behind the scenes, these influential people in society and in the church and to run things. And like I said, I've personally been accused of being like an Opus Dei plant or something like that. And I just have to chuckle at this one because all my experience at Opus Dei, they had no desire to influence the church or even politics. In fact, I was a little bit frustrated. I thought they should have done more to try and influence politics because they would get people who would be well connected in politics. This is Washington, D.C., of course. And they never, ever mentioned political things during their meetings. They never promoted a certain way of looking at things. In fact, I was kind of like, why don't you do more? In fact, I remember bringing that up one time to an Opus Dei numerary, like, why don't you do more, like push pro-life more? And they basically said, hey, we definitely are pro-life and support the work of pro-lifers who are trying to end abortion. It's just simply not our mission to focus on political things, but more importantly, not to tell people what to do in politics or in the church. Our mission is to help them to grow in holiness. Now, an outflowing of that obviously might be they might get more involved in pro-life work, but they're not going to tell you to do that. So the idea that Opus Dei somehow is pulling the strings behind the scenes of high-level politicians or high-level church figures, I think is just ridiculous. Further, I think it's obvious the way the church is run, particularly in the last 9 years, is contrary to the deserved reputation of Opus Dei being a conservative outfit. I mean, clearly the church isn't being run by conservative bishops. I mean, it's Gomez in Los Angeles, Archbishop Gomez. He's an Opus Dei priest, and yet he hasn't been made a cardinal. And like his bishop under him, McElroy in San Diego, has been made a cardinal. I mean, Los Angeles is a cardinalate see, yet he hasn't been made a cardinal. So clearly, if Opus Dei has influence or tries to pull influence, they're terrible at it inside the church. So I think the conspiracy theories, this one, I really feel like they just aren't true. There's no real evidence. It's always just a matter of people saying, oh, yeah, you can do that. You know, they do this, they do that. But there's never any evidence of it. It's like the evidence they have for me. I wrote a book about St. Jose Maria Escrivá. And so therefore, I'm an Opus Dei plant. It's just now, of course, if I was an Opus Dei plant, I would be saying this, wouldn't I? I'd be saying I wasn't. Whoa. Okay, so maybe we'll never know. Another criticism of Opus Dei that I've heard, like the traditionalist criticisms of Opus Dei, and I wrote an article about this for Crisis. I'll link to it in the show notes below, and so you can look into that. And essentially, the criticism is that Opus Dei doesn't fight the battles in the church for traditionalism. They're too quick to be improperly obedient to Pope Francis, not just obedient like we should be, but improperly obedient. And I address those criticisms there. So I'm not going to go over them again. I just encourage you to read that article. Essentially, I will say this, that St. Jose Maria Escrivá himself loved the Latin Mass, the traditional Latin Mass. And in fact, he was given an exemption that he could continue to celebrate the Latin Mass even after 1970, when every other priest was supposed to celebrate the Novus Ordo. He continued to celebrate the Latin Mass until his death in 1975. So clearly he had a love for that. Now, it's true, Opus Dei priests do not celebrate the Latin Mass. I don't know if they do ever, but definitely their regular Mass they celebrate is the Novus Ordo. But they celebrate it very reverently. They celebrate it. They're very serious about it. You don't get clown masses at Opus Dei from Opus Dei priests. That's all I'll say on that. But like I said, just read my article about that. And so finally, the one last thing I would just want to talk about with Opus Dei is the fact is you will probably not become a member of Opus Dei. I will not become a member of Opus Dei. Very few Catholics will become a member of Opus Dei. So why should we care about this? I think it's because, again, St. Jose Maria Escrivá, I think he's a saint that deserves to be known outside of the Opus Dei world. It's not like St. Francis of Assisi is only useful for Franciscans, members of Franciscan Order, or St. Teresa of Avila is only useful for members of the Carmelite Order. Likewise, St. Jose Maria Escrivá is not useful only for members of Opus Dei. I think he's a modern saint in the best way, in the sense that he helps us to be a saint in the modern world. Not that he's a modernist, in other words. He's trying to not make us be more modern. He's trying to make modern people more saintly. And so I really do think St. Jose Maria Escrivá is helpful for all. Again, that's why I wrote the book, Holiness for Everyone. And I would just encourage people, first of all, pick up my book if you want to learn more about it, but also, more importantly, read St. Jose Maria Escrivá himself. He's written a number of things. There's a website. I think I forgot to link to it in the show notes, but it's basically, I think, escrivaworks.org or something like that, where all his writings are online for free. But I would recommend you get his books. Particularly, the most famous book is The Way. That's the one most people know about. And it's basically 999 little nuggets of wisdom, spiritual wisdom. I picked one at random. I honestly just opened the book. Number 711, Another Fall. And what a fall. Despair? No. Humble yourself and through Mary, your mother, have recourse to the merciful love of Jesus. Ah, miserere, have mercy on me and lift up your heart. And now begin again. I mean, that's just something that we can contemplate and think about. We all fall, and we all are in danger of falling into despair when we fall. And yet, St. Jose Maria gives us a little advice. Humble yourself, and through Mary, your mother, have recourse to the merciful love of Jesus. Lift up your heart. Begin again. I mean, that's the practical wisdom. That's practical spirituality of St. Jose Maria Escriva. He's a contemplative, but he's not up in this spiritual world so much so that us normal people can't access it. He makes it accessible to us. So I'd encourage you to get the way to read St. Jose Maria's works, to pick up my book, Holiness for Everyone, as well. And so I personally think Opus Dei itself is a force for good in the world and in the church. It's not for everybody. In fact, it's not for most people. Opus Dei members themselves will say it's really a calling. And so if you don't have that, you shouldn't even try to join. So Opus Dei is not for everybody. But I do think St. Jose Maria Escriva is for everyone. And so I'd encourage you to learn more about St. Jose Maria Escriva. Do a little research. Learn more. If you want to learn more about Opus Dei, you could probably read Scott Hahn's book on it. That's probably the best one to kind of learn about the organization better. And so I just encourage you to learn more about St. Jose Maria Escriva and try to incorporate some of his practical spirituality in your own life to help you become saints, because after all, that's what it's all about, right? Okay, everybody, until next time, God love you.